Hello, Reading. This is Dr. Orna Gill on the Dr. Orna Gill Show here on KCNR 96.5 FM, Your Talk Radio. Today, our show is on the topic of COVID-19 update as of March 26, 2020. We have amazing guests joining us tonight with experts in both the community and outside of the community. We have with us today Casey Fatch, the CEO of Shasta Regional Medical Center. We have Dr. Matt Miles, the Director of Infectious Diseases at Shasta Regional Medical Center. We have Dr. James Taggart, the Medical Director of the Emergency Department and Emergency Services at Shasta Regional Medical Center. And joining us on the phone later will be Dr. Michael Lin, MD, PhD, the Principal Investigator at the Lin Labs at Stanford University, and a world-renowned expert and researcher of coronaviruses in general. So he'll be updating us on his best practices and understandings, as well as Dr. Nanda Kumar, the Medical Director of and Chief of Staff of Vibra Hospital in Redding, California. He'll be giving us some perspectives on how to handle this pandemic from a personal all the way through to community level. So welcome, gentlemen, to the studio. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's start with the stats, just to get basic information down first. Dr. Miles, tell us what the new stats are with regard to our community, California, and around the world. What are we looking at right now?
Well, fortunately, we're actually still looking okay here in Reading. We have had 3 cases thus far. We do have a number of patients that we're looking at daily as far as ruling the disease out. And so from a testing standpoint, we've probably looked at well over 100 cases as far as seeing whether that disease is present within the community. Obviously, there's greater activity elsewhere within the state and nationally, and those numbers continue to rise.
What about in California? Do you see that a difference in the amount of cases in California and the amount that they're doubling versus in other places?
I think California still has rising numbers, probably certainly not as great as some of the other areas of the country. I think California's up to about 4,000 cases now, but certainly not as bad as some of the areas back east.
Yeah. And what are the new policies that the hospitals put into place to make us all safe from this?
Probably the 2 biggest policies that I can name would be visitor restriction. It's interesting to walk around the hospital now. It's emptier than you've ever seen before. And I think from a staff standpoint, they feel safer in that regard with just less people present, similar to the social distancing we're doing in the outside world. The other big thing, surgeries have been cut down, which also cuts down on the census level, certainly in the hospital, which isn't a favorable thing for hospitals, but certainly from the epidemic standpoint, it's a favorable thing.
And how has the ER changed, Dr. Taggart?
We have a strict screening process out front. So any patient with any one of the symptoms of COVID-19 will be evaluated outside, both by a nurse, a tech, and often a physician assistant or a physician prior to bringing them into the emergency department. We've even done some treatment in radiology and x-rays outside if it was felt that a chest x-ray was needed, but it was likely not coronavirus, or because anyone that we are testing is, at this point, is either being admitted, and we have a few high suspicion patients with risk factors that we might test and send home if they are feeling and looking okay.
Wow. And what has stayed the same in terms of hospital policies, or what's basically the same in the hospital? Is there anything that we, for example, in terms of isolation or in terms of treatment of patients who don't have that kind of problem?
Our treatment for every other medical condition, our treatment has remained the same.
Yeah.
We are still seeing patients in a very timely manner and getting them either admitted and getting them the services that they need, whether they're admitted to the hospital, going to the OR, or being discharged home. We have very strict personal protection that we use, includes masks, face shields, gloves, and gowns. And we have a negative pressure room that we use for patients that are under investigation for COVID-19. And those patients under investigation that are ill are admitted to a negative pressure room upstairs. They're tested and given whatever treatments that they might need.
Can you explain to us what a negative pressure room is for and why we have it, how it prevents disease from spreading?
In basic terms, basically, a negative pressure room is simply so that you're not getting airflow from that room out to the general area of the hospital. You're getting it filtered out of the room to the environment. And so, therefore, the direct opposite would be positive pressure, you know, venting air from the room out into the general hospital area. But here we have air flowing to the outside.
There's a, you know, a lot of people I've heard have said, well, we're scared to go to the hospital even if we're sick. We're scared to go to the hospital even if we're hurt. We're scared to get even next to the hospital, and that can delay treatment of some diseases and treatment of some real symptoms of catastrophic disease. How do you address people who are so scared to come to the hospital even if they are sick?
Well, I still think the emergency department, especially here at Shasta Regional, is very safe. Mm-hmm. We are taking every precaution possible. And if you deem or think you have an emergency, I think it is imperative that you seek emergency care. Mm-hmm. And we are still treating heart attacks, strokes, and any other medical condition that requires immediate or urgent intervention.
Good.
So at the same time, I think it has been extremely valuable that patients are staying home that don't have an emergency mm-hmm. and that can possibly be seen by their primary care doctor. Doing this isolation at home and avoiding whether it's the ER or a grocery store will limit the spread. And the transmission of the virus. And so I think it will have dramatic impact on the number of positive cases that we see in the community here.
Hmm. And what can we do as members of the community to help our doctors and nurses, our hospitals, our schools, our senior citizens, and our law enforcement under these new circumstances? Any special guidelines that any kind of tips that you guys can give us to both protect ourselves and our seniors and our schools? How do we help?
Well, I think one thing to remember is that this virus is spread by droplets.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's not thought, the main transmission is not thought to be airborne. It's by droplets. So people coughing or sneezing, you need to cover your cough, you need to cover your sneeze with your elbow. You need to wash your arms and hands with soap and water for 20 seconds. I think the elderly should not be going out to get groceries or do other things. I think they should be staying home and having friends and family bring them anything that they may need at home. Now, that doesn't mean they can't go out and take a walk and do their usual daily activities outside that may be in the backyard or in a park. But at the same time, you need to remember that when you do go to a grocery store or other places and you're touching things and someone just sneezed on that can of beans, that it could be contaminated. I think it's relatively low risk. I think people are cognizant and aware that they need to cover their mouth, and they shouldn't be out in public if they're sneezing and coughing. Yeah. That's the number one thing. If you are ill, you need to stay home. Doing that will save other people's lives significantly.
That's very helpful. That's very helpful. We are anticipating a caller from Stanford University. His name is Dr. Michael Lin. He is an MD and a PhD and the principal investigator at the Lin Labs in Stanford University and an expert researcher on coronaviruses. Dr. Lynn, welcome to the show. It is an honor to speak with you today. Thank you for joining us.
Certainly. Thank you, Dr. Gill, for having me on.
A pleasure. We'd like you to tell us a little bit about the basic science behind COVID-19, or as you call it, COVID-SARS-2. Tell us a little bit about that and what possible treatments are available after. Well, let's just start with the basics, you know.
Sure. Yeah, this is a virus that's actually very similar to a virus that we have been studying for 17 years now. And that's the virus for SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. So some of us may remember in 2003 there was this outbreak of a disease that's very similar to the one we're seeing now in COVID-19. That virus was sequenced and studied in the lab extensively. And the sequence of the current virus for COVID-19, which scientifically is called SARS-CoV-2, is very similar to that virus, about 90% similar. This is a virus that originally came from bats. It's a class of viruses that's known to spread from different kinds of animal hosts. It's also very similar to the virus that caused Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, a few years ago. And so we know a lot about it in the lab, and many screens have been done under laboratory conditions to find drugs or chemical compounds that can serve as therapies. And we also have some experience building vaccines for SARS and MERS. The eradication of SARS and MERS has meant that these therapies haven't progressed all the way through clinical trials. Once those diseases were eradicated through public health measures alone, then there were no longer any patients to try the new drugs on. So for better or worse, we've had to resuscitate those drug development efforts now. But I think in the next few months, we'll start seeing clinical trials initiate using new therapies that are developed for SARS-CoV-2.
And what possible treatments are available on the horizon that you know of? What kind of vaccines are on the horizon? How close are we to getting there?
So there are many things being worked on. Some of you may have heard of a few drugs that might have some efficacy against the virus. One that's gotten a lot of press is chloroquine and its related drug, hydroxychloroquine. These are drugs that are used, that were used decades ago to, as a prophylactic, as a prevention for malaria. And so they're now generic drugs, and they're cheap to manufacture. There have been, reports of positive results, from China, but the actual results of those trials, have not been revealed, so we don't really know how well it worked. And then there's one report from France. It's a small study, and it seemed to show some benefit. But there are some issues with that study that make it unclear how much benefit was really due to chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine. Regardless, these are drugs that some people are getting now. I think Dr. Taggart could tell us in more detail, but many hospitals are prescribing these drugs for severe cases of the virus. But they're definitely not a cure. Patients who are on the drug sometimes get worse, sometimes get better, and that's why it's hard to know how well they're working. And then there are other drugs that, have come out of screens from either this virus or the previous related virus, which can be started testing in humans relatively quickly. One that some of you may have heard of is remdesivir. It's in phase 3 trials in multiple locations in multiple countries. For COVID-19, and it's a drug that's made for viruses, and it shows activity against a wide spectrum of viruses. So there's a lot of hope that one will be at least as good as chloroquine, if not better.
Are there any negative side effects that we can anticipate with any one of these medications or vaccines?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, chloroquine is known as having various side effects, some problems with your vision. It causes a regular heartbeat. So it's not something you want to take unless you really have to. So people are not advised to go out and seek a prescription for chloroquine at this time unless they're in a hospital. And then the remdesivir drug, it may have some side effects, but it's thought to be relatively mild. That was a drug that was developed for Ebola and has been tested in patients, and so we have a good idea of its safety. But I think what many people want to know about is the prospects for a vaccine. So, you know, something that you can, a shot that you can take that will prevent you from ever coming down with the disease from this virus would, of course, be fantastic. There are vaccines that have already been started in trials. One that some of you may have heard about is an RNA-based vaccine. So that means taking RNA, which is the instruction set for creating a protein from this virus, and injecting that into patients. And the patient's own cells will take up the RNA and then produce this copy of a virus protein, and that will initiate your immune response to react against that protein. And so this is this work has already been started. The vaccine trial was started in Seattle recently, and we might expect to see results from that in a couple of months. But then scaling up the production of that vaccine will take time, and then making sure it's really safe may take a little bit more time. And so at the earliest, that's maybe ready next year, early next year. And so in the meantime, we have to control the virus using public health measures like social distancing, or work from home.
And can you give us some advice a little bit about how you kill the virus?
Yeah, the virus is not particularly strong. It's actually a virus that's easy to kill. The virus is held together by a thin membrane. It's made out of just two molecules thick. And so this is a membrane that's easily broken apart by any kind of detergent or by any kind of solvent. And so an example of detergents are soaps, dishwashing soap, hand soap, any kind of shampoo. Those are all kill the virus. That's why we are encouraged to wash our hands. And solvents are, for example, ethanol, isopropanol, so that's just rubbing alcohol. 75% ethanol, isopropanol will kill the virus. And that's the stuff that's in hand sanitizer. So hand sanitizer will kill the virus. So basically, things that you would do to clean things are very effective at killing and getting rid of the virus.
What about?
Go ahead.
What about sunlight and UV light and heat and that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. So those things actually also will kill the virus. It's hard to get exact controlled conditions for those things. But, the research on coronaviruses has suggested that they will, if you leave something out in the sun in broad sunlight for 3 to 6 hours, you'll see a 90% reduction in the amount of viable living virus. And so that's, that means that things that are outside will get decontaminated by the sunlight pretty soon, pretty rapidly. Heat also will kill the virus, and so just heating up to 70 degrees Celsius, which is about 160, 170 degrees Fahrenheit, that will kill the virus. If you have a toaster oven, you can put something in there. But most things will melt if you put it in the oven, so it's not really practical as a method for decontamination.
Yeah.
But certainly as the weather warms up, we might expect that things that are left outside will self-decontaminate faster. But again, that's not it's not immediate, so it's not something, it's not a guaranteed way of avoiding virus. You want to still take very careful measures, such as washing your hands after you touch a foreign object or washing objects that people give to you.
So give us some takeaway tips for ways that we can continue to prevent the spread in our community. Because from what I understand, we were talking about, if I'm right, Dr. Miles, three active three cases right now?
Correct.
So how how do we keep it that way? Is there any way to know how many to anticipate, or can we anticipate that this is something that will double very soon? How do you, what can we expect at this point?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, the way I look at it now is that we should take action to reduce the risk of transmission. The numbers of people in the population who have the virus can spread it. You know, in one sense, you could think of being low, but in another sense, you could think of as being high enough to be concerned. The number of people who have the virus might be something like 1 in 1,000. So, that's reassuring in some sense, but then you have to prepare for the possibility that anyone you encounter might be the 1 in 1,000. So I would avoid crowded places. I would actually try to do as much shopping online as possible, because it's better for your thing to be delivered by one or two people who have touched it, rather than, for example, going to the grocery store and then going to the checkout stand and having your items be handled by the cashier who has handled items from 100 people before you. So I think steps, easy steps that you can take to reduce your exposure would be helpful. And again, because the virus is on a fragile side for virus, we just have to break the chain of transmission as much as possible to make a real effect on the spread, on the numbers in the community. And as Dr. Taggart said, if you're on the older side, you might want to be more careful. You might want to restrict your interactions with other people even more. Or if you're a younger person who sees an older person, you also want to be very careful. And so that's, again, washing your hands before you encounter somebody who might be susceptible, after you touch something that might be dirty or contaminated. So just keeping you and your objects clean would make a huge difference.
Very interesting. Appreciate your time today, Dr. Lin. It's been a pleasure and honor to speak with you. And thank you for your contribution to this topic, both in the lab and today in our studio. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Wonderful. We also, I wanted to ask you, Dr. Miles, about how the virus can spread even if we don't have symptoms. When does it start to manifest, and when are we really infectious, and how would we know?
So there's this, one of the concerns out there is that asymptomatic individuals can transmit the virus, and we know that can occur, although if you look at some of the big databases that are out there now, especially out of China, it's really a small proportion of the cases that are asymptomatic that have had detection of virus. There is a concern about those patients that are just mildly symptomatic that are within the community. You know, the patients that are more severely ill are obviously in the hospital. We have a little bit better control of them, but the mildly symptomatic ones are the ones that are going to lead to significant transmission within the community. So that's one of the major concerns.
And what about the makeup of our community? A lot of people talk about the age pyramid that we have in different communities, so that you have, like, on some communities, for example, China, you have quite a top-heavy community in terms of how much more proportional, a high proportion of older individuals as opposed to younger ones, similarly in Italy.
Yeah, I think that was one of the concerns in Italy, certainly, is that they had an older population. And I think if you look at your own community and you feel like you have a more elderly population, that's going to be a concern. And this has already sort of been spoken to, but, right, all the individuals in that community need to take care, because we all have contact with each other, even though we may not know it in certain circumstances. And so even if you're in your 20s and you feel really healthy, you still need to take care, because you do affect the health of all those around you in your community. And so this whole idea of social distancing, it doesn't just apply if you're at risk because you have medical problems or you're older in age. I mean, it really should. It applies to everyone within the community to do their part to cut that transmission.
And in terms of when we can anticipate this to kind of get more and more, or more draconian in terms of how we have to stay perhaps even more isolated at home, what do you have any kind of predictions in that? Do you think that we can anticipate that, or do you think that we should not really worry?
worry about the social distancing part, but I think it's, I don't know, I think it's interesting. I, you know, it'd be interesting to be sitting in New York right now and to see whether everyone has enough fear that they're starting to comply with that a little bit more. I think we sit in communities sometimes and maybe get a little complacent, where you probably should not at this point, because if you really look at the numbers throughout the country, most places are certainly on the rise. And so I think if everyone can sort of suck it up and do the right thing for the next several weeks, I think then we'll get a good idea. I've kind of said I think April is going to be a very telling month to see where we're going to go next. And I think this is your time, and it probably was even before this, but your time is definitely now that you need to participate in those sort of precautions so that we can avoid a really significant rise.
I think it's very important to emphasize that we started social distancing a little bit before other places in the United States, and that may be what we are seeing. Do you think those the consequence of our smaller numbers?
I would agree. It very well may be the case. I think California did a pretty good job. That's my feeling. And whether that wasn't taking place in some areas, I think some people believe that was the case. So I think that's been in our favor. You look at Washington right now, and things seem to be hopefully settling down for them, too. And they were obviously the first state to be involved. And I think, once again, I think cases in your presence generate a little bit of a stimulus to do the right thing.
That's
so
right. That's an interesting point. We also wanted to bring in another caller, Dr. Nanda Kumar. If he's on the line, or not yet. I'm told that he's not on the line yet. We will be speaking to him a little bit about how to invoke the optimism approach, and he will describe that to us when he comes up on the line. So let's talk a little bit more about what you think in terms of what we can do. What do we know right now? And just practically speaking, what is social distancing, and how will it affect our economy, for example?
Well, that
we can
go ahead.
There's a lot out there on that. I think when you look at the number of 188,000. Unemployment claims that were filed just last week alone, which was the largest ever, and Governor Newsom predicted today that this week would be a million. And there's been a significant amount of layoffs. We've closed the restaurants and bars and a lot of other movie theaters everywhere. Concerts are shut down. I mean, it's going to have a significant temporary impact on the economy. I think everybody has to stop using the term depression or recession. I think the perspective is you look at it as like a big natural disaster, okay? And it's going to hit us all, and we'll get through it. But when we come back, the infrastructure is going to be intact. The economy will be able to start right up. So we just got to get through that whatever amount of period of time that is. And so that's something that's encouraging. I think it's part of the one of the reasons why the president and Congress's package is going to address a lot of, they're going to at least give us a couple of months to see how this plays out.
Mm-hmm. That's important to take note of, is how to survive this economically speaking. Do we anticipate assistance to come relatively soon, or? How do we plan our day?
Yeah, the unemployment claims are out there, and across the country, I've seen a bunch of different statistics for different states, and it's going to be a significant number, but again, it's only going to be temporary. There's also some dollars coming out of the stimulus package that will go to individuals making a certain amount and tapering off for the more wealthy, and that'll be an immediate cash transfer to their. To their bank accounts. From what I'm told, if you have IRS
direct deposit,
then the dollars would just flow right through that directly. And I think it was $1,200 for adults and $500 for each child in the family.
Oh, that's significant. And so one of the things I also wanted to point out that was what data do we have from other places, and how to contend with the psychiatric sort of impacts of of distancing and isolation. Certainly people who are dependent on seeing their grandparents every week or their grandchildren, hugging them, or, you know, even just the impact of just not having human touch in your everyday lifestyle. How does that do? What do we know from data around the world in that respect? Are you aware of any?
I don't know of any data on that issue. I think we're all we're very aware of that situation going on. In various arenas. I think, in the hospital, that's a very tough decision to restrict visitors. Yeah. You look at patients. And, I've always said the patients who have visitors, they seem to thrive a little bit better. And the ones that don't, you can sort of see it's a little bit of more of a struggle. And so I think that's a really tough decision, but I think it was necessary. And, hopefully nurses and nurses' aides and all the other ancillary staff that's in the hospital and the doctors can sort of encourage those patients and keep them moving in the right direction. But I think it's hard for families not being there as well. And I think everyone struggles, even outpatient. We all have older individuals that we care about that we're not necessarily having contact with. So it does have a big, I think, emotional, mental impact. All the way down to, the younger generations. You have all these kids that are out of school and they're in a situation. I think some of them like it, some of them don't like it. it's definitely something that no one has experienced before, and some people are having a tough time processing it.
One of the ways that we're dealing with it at Chester Regional Medical Group is through telemedicine. And so we're doing a lot of encounters through telemedicine there. And we're going to be just discussing some other telemedicine options for the hospital as well, starting next week.
It's interesting because, it's about maintaining not just mental, social health, it's physical health. Are there ways that we can, that you all can give us some advice on how to stay healthy in order to really combat the virus if we do get infected, or how to keep our immune systems really healthy prior to, having to contend with it in a big way?
Well, I would say this would be a good time to stop smoking.
Okay.
That is a big risk factor for those that smoke. They tend to have more severe disease. If you have diabetes, I would work really hard at controlling your blood sugars and checking more frequently. I would make sure that whether you're young or old, that you get adequate sleep so that your body can recover and do the things that it needs to do to within its immune system. And then, of course, diet, making sure that you are eating a healthy, balanced diet, although now we've got just takeout and fast food joints.
But, exactly.
But I think that's important, and it may be more challenging, actually, for some people to have the diet maybe that they were on before this all started. But those are the things that I would recommend.
I have a lot of questions about things that, the concept of disinformation that are coming out at us. There's so many ways for us to become inundated with beliefs and with false truths. And I just want to make sure that we have the access to really myth versus truth. For example, the last show I did, there was a paper that came out from Japan that said that drinking fluids would kill the virus and by passing it into your GI tract. And that's not true, right?
No.
Definitely not.
That I've heard.
I want to make that correction. That's important to know. Let's continue with that. What about if someone
holds their breath for 10 seconds? Remember that one?
Yeah.
If you can hold your breath for 10 seconds, you don't have the coronavirus. And, and I saw Geraldo Rivera say that on the news.
Yeah.
I witnessed it. So.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. It was there.
And I'm being told that we have Dr. Nanda Kumar on the line. He is the medical director and chief of staff of Vibra Hospital in Redding, California. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us, Dr. Nanda Kumar. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill, for this opportunity.
It's an honor. We all wanted to, we're all here together talking about COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2. And you spoke to me yesterday a little bit about your concept of the optimism approach. Will you please explain to us what that is and what your concept of the optimism approach is and how to handle this?
Yes, Dr. Gill. This viral pandemic has affected the whole globe, and the whole globe is fighting against one enemy like it has never been before. And all these resources that are happening all over the world are being utilized to find the solutions. And I'll come to it in a bit before talking about how do we get stronger health-wise from this viral pandemic, which has almost hit a global pause. Most people now are confined in the home, shelter in place, or in quarantine. And how do we emerge from this? By not only spreading the disease by physical distancing, hand washing, and other things, but how do we emerge from this in more healthy ways?
Yeah.
Health, as defined by World Health Organization, is a complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So as we prevent the spread of the disease, and we have this time to be in the home, this time should be used to improve the health in terms of nutrition, better exercising on a regular basis, and having adequate sleep, bringing meditative practices, and improve the overall health. This viral pandemic has also unleashed a fear pandemic that is causing a lot of fear, anxiety, and that is also fueled by the continuous news cycle of negative information, and some of it is not true, powered by the commercial artificial intelligence. So how to deal with this stress and anxiety is very important as we improve the physical health by the measures we discussed, with regular exercise, nutrition, sleep, meditation, and other things. We have to find time to use this time in a more enjoyable and rather productive way by picking up new activities. Even in World War I and II, they have used this music as a method to deal with the anxiety and stress, and to improve the virtual social interaction. Nowadays, there are a lot of webcams of virtual travel available. People can live stream the places of interest. There are sites like 100 Ways to Travel Without Leaving Home and spend extra quality time with friends and family, because the fear and anxiety created is quite detrimental, and the families have also to see who is coping well with a better perspective and who is suffering from over-anxiety and stress. So when there is so much of anxiety, this anxiety calls for some control in the situation where there is uncontrolled, we don't have much control, and this leads to the dysfunctional or some of the irrational activities like hoarding. Nowadays we see so much toilet paper in the homes, but no toilet paper in the stores. So all this results from a lot of anxiety, and some of this is powered by the kind of news coverage and the artificial intelligence that seems to exploit the cognitive basis, leading to polarization, misinformation, disinformation, and racism. So today there are a lot of artificial intelligence specialists trying to find these sources of disinformation tracking and build the artificial intelligence technology to dispel these. So the artificial intelligence that has become the problem is now helping to solve this kind of cognitive bias, polarizing, amplifying the panic, and that kind of situation. So, with this prolonged period of being at home, I wish to emphasize that everything should be done to improve the general health. So, at the same time, as the whole globe is fighting with this viral enemy that has transcended all geographic areas, and it doesn't discriminate between rich, poor, age. So there is so much research going on, and there is so much sharing of this information across all countries in a more public way. The information is being digitalized. Once it is digitalized, it is more democratic and demonetized. It is available free to the whole world. And to give some of the examples that lead to a lot of hope and optimism, we have known this virus only for 4 months. But now there are currently 34 vaccines under development in the world, and some of these are going to be very effective. And this has changed the perspective also in the research community, that now there are a drug development alliances between the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Scripps, and there are a lot of drugs being available. Dr. Gee, is this sound about the time or?
This is 100%. This is fascinating. No one wants to interrupt you because it is so brilliantly put. We just said we're all jaw dropping right now. The pandemic of fear concept is very beautifully stated and very accurate. And so I believe that you're very articulate on this topic and very calming just to even listen to you speak on it. The best ways to utilize our time, as you said, are to employ virtual tools that are interactive, like you said. You said, how, for example, would we preserve our intellectual faculties and social health through, what kind of suggestions can you give us for that?
So in this time, when we are at, most people of this whole globe are at home, except those in emergency services, apart from getting good exercise, sleep, meditation, people should look for activities that can enhance their quality of life. Entrepreneurs and people who want to build something can look at all the problems that the world is facing and come up with solutions that are small and big. And develop a new talent. Help people, our friends and families who are not able to really cope with this well. Improve their social interaction. Learn more from the web of all the available things. And this fear pandemic is also being fueled by the 24-hour news cycle. Anybody who is not being able to be more productive in this time of rest should try to limit their news exposure to once or twice a day and just go for reliable sources like the CDC or the government sites for the information, then being it's difficult to maintain a positive outlook in the bombardment of negative data. So at the end of all this, with the new vaccines, with the new developments in drugs, with the new testing, for example, in Colorado, San Miguel County, where Telluride is, the United Biotechnology is coming to test everybody with the antibiotics and antibodies and see how many have developed the disease and how many are improving. So such studies are going to grow exponentially. And the pandemic platform is being built to deal with so that this is going to be a practice pandemic so that next time when anything like this happens, by a combination of artificial intelligence, sensors and networks, solutions will be developed instantaneously when a new virus develops. It's important to know that there are 1,600 viruses that can cause these pandemics. And once in a few years, we see things like Zika virus, West Nile virus, and now COVID-19 that are examples of these. And there are now efforts to study them, map them, and be able to deal with them in more effective ways to have a global alliance against these pandemics. And at the end of it, we will all these give hope that we will have a more perspective on what is important to us, and which will unify the globe in ways it has never happened before.
That is truly a very optimistic approach. I think it's a very beautiful vision, and it's a very positive way to look at it. So you're very optimistic, it sounds like, about where we're going to emerge, or how we're going to emerge, and when we're going to emerge from this. Sounds like.
Yeah. I want to qualify that optimism by saying that it is a data-driven hope and optimism.
Okay. And what do you, Dr. Maz, in terms of your, would you take an optimistic approach to this, or do you have a couple of different points of view that you would like to bring in on the way that we should have?
Well, I think it's a very trying time. So I think the optimism I think will grow as we get through this. But there are some good things I think that will come out of it. And I agree. I don't think you'll probably ever have we've probably never seen a situation where there's sort of some global empathy for each other. Right? We're all going through this together. And I think the cooperation that sort of comes out of it. And I think you can see it on several levels, and even at a local level, if you look at both the hospitals, the two acute care hospitals in this town, I've probably never seen as great a cooperation as you see right now. I mean, just sharing of ideas and trying to make sure we're all on the same page so that the message to the public is the same, certainly working together closely. I'll tell you, your hygiene practices will certainly be a positive that comes out of this, I think. And hopefully we don't lose that social interaction between people, that ability to touch and feel another person. But certainly I think the appropriate hand hygiene that we should all take will be a positive.
I also think Dr. Kumar brought up a good point about where you get your information from. And, I've gotten caught up in the battle of the news stations and the political agendas. And now I've stopped and I look at CDC's website. I look at CDPH's website, which is California Department of Public Health. And I look at Shasta County's website and then watch Netflix.
Yes, I've also stopped watching the news, cable news channels, because I found that I don't always believe what I'm hearing, and there's some misinformation, and then it just tends to create some anxiety. So I try and stick to what I know is reliable. The other website that's been useful is the Johns Hopkins website for infectious disease.
Yeah, the cooperation between private and public institutions, for example, Johns Hopkins and some of the news media, or some of the academic institutions and the big pharma companies coming together to, you know, traditional enemies coming together to cooperate really over a pandemic that needs to be quickly addressed. And one thing that Dr. Kumar mentioned is that this is a practice pandemic. What do you think about that concept, Dr. Miles? Can you explain
that? I think it's probably, unfortunately, probably true, and I think it is. I mean, we all need to sort of go through this process and so that we can do things better the next time. I mean, that's with everything in life, right?
How do you so this is not the last time now?
Well, I'm sure there's another pandemic down the line.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully not for a long, hopefully not in our lifetime.
Right. The last pandemic I think that we're drawing from on this scale, would you say is the Spanish flu, or would you say is 2003? How would you?
Well, I would say probably the one that, you know, in 2009 we dealt with H1N1, and I think for most of us that's probably some clinical experience comes out of that that helped us a little bit. But I don't think any of us, you know, if you, obviously looking back all the way to 1918, you know, none of us have an experience there. And times were obviously different, I mean, with technology and the lives we live now. But, you know, I think that lesson, as good as it maybe was, I don't think it necessarily prepared us for what this one was. I think no one really felt that we were going to see something like this happen. And so it's tough to deal with, and we're going to learn from it and be better prepared for what comes down the line.
My understanding is that...
Probably does,
Go ahead.
Probably does, Miles already mentioned. We always talked about the respiratory spread, but now we know that 54% of COVID patients have evidence of viral RNA in the stools, and so they are coming with diarrhea instead of fever, and so that's an important thing, that it could be transmitted through the stool or the toilet seats, and that seems to be somewhat of a newer information.
Yeah, that is correct. In one Chinese study, over a little over half of the patients had some GI symptoms, and so those that have GI symptoms were also seen to have more severe disease. So there is, and then the other information is that trying to recall, over 50% of patients in this country are middle aged. I forget the time bracket on that, you know, so and these patients generally have more mild disease, and I think the importance of that fact is that there are a lot more people out there that have the disease that are recovering and getting better than are coming to the hospitals and requiring admission. And our concerns from a hospital organization and physician standpoint is making sure that we have the resources in the hospital to meet the needs.
That's a very optimistic and hopeful way to finish, that we are seeing a lot of patients actually doing better at home, and what we hear about are the bad cases, but in fact we have a very large cohort of good healing people in the community. And so I'd like to say thank you to everyone in the studio today for participating in this very, very important and vital topic on the COVID-19. I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Nanda Kumar, Dr. Lin, Dr. Taggart, Dr. Miles, Casey Thatch, and to all of our viewers and audience, not viewers.
Listeners.
And right, and to our audiences for listening and for participating and for making this a better place and a healthier place to live. And also, shout out to Linda Bott from all of us in the studio.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.